This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for stage dramas or a unique storytelling event, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. A military code of honor is on trial as the NOLA Project presents Aaron Sorkin's critically acclaimed courtroom drama, A Few Good Men. A high-level conspiracy unfolds in this 1980s Broadway hit as military lawyers defend two U.S. Marines accused of murder. Joining me is director Jason Kirkpatrick and actor Michael Santos. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, thanks.
This must be an exciting time for you as you are opening in a new theater space with an iconic American story.
This is Michael. It's very exciting. Just as a faculty member of Delgado, this is our fourth production, but it's our first invited professional theater production. So it's breaking some new ground, and I know Delgado is excited to have the NOLA Project.
And the space itself is gorgeous. It's an amazing state-of-the-art theater.
It's renovated. It's been there for 20 years. It's just taken us that long to finally get all the renovations done to it. The space, like Jason said, is beautiful. And named after the late Timothy K. Baker, who really founded the theater department at Delgado.
So let's set the stage. What's being explored in this drama?
This is Jason. Personal honor. And the question of where do your limits lie in terms of what you believe in and what you think makes an honorable human. And if that's questioned by some indoctrination, if you're in any branch of the military, for example, in this play, do you give up your personal code of honor to take on a code of honor for someone else? And what are the consequences of that if you do? That's one of the themes. And another one is, because the play is set in 1986 and we're doing it now, there is one female in the play, and it's pretty big to think that there's one female in this play about the military. And what does it mean? You know, how far have we come, and have we even come far enough? And how women are treated in the military and in the workforce and anywhere where there's men dominating the place.
So how does the story unfold?
There are two Marines that get caught up in a botched hazing event that's not really on the books. It's something that's a part of the Marines that's sort of just a code red, what they call it, which is kind of a hazing, like you would have at a fraternity or something. And one of the younger Marines that's being hazed, he dies because of it. Then there is conspiracy that comes up. There is murder. Was it on purpose? Was it an accident? Who is actually at fault? So the two Marines that did the code red are arrested, and they're charged with murder. Is it going to go to trial, or is it going to be just a plea bargain?
And Michael, tell us about your character, your role.
I play Lieutenant Colonel Nathan Jessup. He is the commanding officer at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, of the Marine Station there. And in the 80s, we're still very much in the Cold War and the fear of communism, socialism, and Cuba really becomes this front line. These are people at the ready to give their lives, but also take lives. So it's a completely different environment than we might be a little used to as seeing what Gitmo is now. In the 80s, it's definitely a different place. He gets word that Santiago, the character who is given the code red, who loses his life, that he wants to transfer and that he's writing to senators and other people to try to get off the base rather than going through that strict chain of command that is so highly regarded and taught in the military. His idea is that that kind of behavior has to be trained out of you, that it's a selfless service to the men in your squad, to the mission at hand, and to the Marines as a whole. So his methods of what he calls train Santiago go horribly awry, and it's the cover-up that ensues that really seals his fate.
And I see you've brought a clip with you.
Yeah, this speech that Jessup gives really encapsulates his mental conception of what his job is, the idea that he's there on the front lines to save lives, and that Santiago's are a means to an end, and that there are casualties in war, and Santiago happens to be one, but he will continue to fight, and you need people like him in order to carry the fight, because freedom isn't free.
Because the truth is, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's going to do it? You? You, Lieutenant Weinberg? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You weep for Santiago when you curse the Marines. You have that luxury, the luxury of the blind, the luxury of not knowing what I know, that Santiago's death, while tragic, probably saved lives, and that my existence, while grotesque and incomprehensible to you, saves lives. You can't handle it, because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties, you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. We use words like honor, code, loyalty. We use them as a backbone to a life spent defending something. You use them as a punchline. I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to a man who rises and sleeps under the blanket of the very freedom that I provide and then questions the manner in which I provide it. I would prefer if you just said thank you and went on your way. Otherwise, I suggest you pick up a weapon and stand a post. Either way, I don't give a damn what you think you're entitled to.
There are some things that Sorkin definitely gives you to think about, but at the same time, you question, well, is this really the kind of human condition we want to live under? I find that the play gives a lot more questions than answers, and those are always the most enjoyable for me.
Now, is the play based on a true story?
It is based on an incident that closely resembled what the play is about, but not actual events and people.
So there's a lot of creative license in
the
work?
Oh, absolutely.
And Aaron Sorkin, how did he come to write this play?
I believe that his sister was in the JAG Corps. The JAG Corps is the Judge Advocates General's Corps, the lawyers in the military. And his sister was talking to him about a case that was a lot like this one. And he was extremely intrigued by it. It was like, oh, wow, this is, you know, how much different is, you know, our civilian court in court-martial in the military? And he was a bartender at the time. In New York, and he starts writing dialogue, I think he says, on like cocktail napkins. And so the play was his collection of cocktail napkins that he wrote in a bar.
It's incredible.
It is. Yeah. I think that is an incredible story. Somebody had said that he still rewrites the play. There's been, if you look in the playbill, there's been so many new copyrights that he's gone back and he keeps revisiting this play because he wants to tweak it and fix it. So he's still writing this play.
Since the late 80s.
Yeah.
Wow. What do you think audiences will be thinking about long after the curtain falls?
Is it okay to be proud to be an American? And even though this might not be the America you voted for, and this might not be the America that you want, is there still a reason for you to be proud to be an American?
To piggyback on that, I hope they have a little self-analysis just of their own lives.
Question orders.
Yeah.
Director Jason Kirkpatrick and actor Michael Santos, thanks for stopping by.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The NOLA Project presents Aaron Sorkin's A Few Good Men in the Timothy Baker Theater at Delgado Community College, 615 City Park Avenue. Performances are running now through February 12th. Scientist, environmentalist, and fisherman will come together Monday, February 6th, to retell the story of the 2010 BP oil spill. They'll talk about their firsthand experiences. It's part of Story Collider, a group that hosts live storytelling events about science in cities across the country. They also have a podcast. WWNO's Tegan Wendland talked with organizer Ari Daniel about the challenges of telling stories about science.
What does it mean to tell stories about science, and what are you trying to accomplish with Story Collider?
We're trying to do a few things. One thing is we want scientists to kind of talk about their work in a way that perhaps they're not used to talk about their lives and what drives them and the kinds of events and episodes that they've experienced in a way that's touched them. And we're also hoping to get our audiences to feel touched by that experience and to feel connected to science in a way that may be different.
And how did you get the idea? You do these events all over the country, right?
Yes, and I should say that the organization was founded by Ben Lilly and Brian Wecht, two physicists who were kind of involved in the storytelling scene and were interested in kind of developing a model where people would be telling stories that kind of connected to science. So Story Collider shows happen all over the country, as you say. We're invited by science festivals, by academic institutions, by conferences to come and put on shows. And the New Orleans show is an example of that.
You did an event in Tampa last year where you had storytellers talking about their research in the Gulf of Mexico. What were some of the surprising things you heard then?
Well, I think that we had a really nice collection of stories last year in Tampa that spanned a variety of different experiences that people had. And they all kind of spoke about the Gulf and about the oil spill, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, from different perspectives and how it really affected them. And for me, it was really striking to listen to these storytellers talk about what that spill meant to them, where they were, the moment when they heard about it, how they were involved with addressing it. To me, that made for a very powerful set of stories that kind of triangulated that experience from different perspectives.
And you're going to share some clips today. Can we hear some of the audio from that event?
Yeah, absolutely. So this first clip, Tegan, is from Kendra Daly, who is a professor in the College of Marine Science at the University of South Florida and was involved in the science response team to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill.
So the scientists asked me if I'd be willing to participate in this emergency response team. So I said yes. I was actually very excited. I thought it sounded like a real adventure. I could help save the planet. Not only that, but it was in the tropics, warm weather, you know, swimming dolphins. Well, I was wrong. It was one of the most horrendous cruises of my life.
And that's interesting because it kind of gives us some insight into how emotional this kind of work can be for scientists. It's a kind of an aspect of that professional work that you don't see very often.
Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, one of our main goals in Story Collider is to reveal that science is an incredibly passionate endeavor. It's full of heart. It's full of emotion. And one of the things we really encourage our storytellers to do is to reveal that part of themselves and that part of science when they get up on stage.
And then we've got another clip that kind of demonstrates the challenges of breaking down science and environmental stories for the public. Can you tell us a little about this?
Yeah, sure. This next clip comes from Jim Verhulst, who's been with the Tampa Bay Times since 1987. He joined the editorial board of that paper in 2008. And Jim talks about the challenges of communicating the science about the Deepwater Horizon oil spill to his readers.
Let's pretend the crude oil is actually gasoline. And let's take that volume of gasoline and let's tank up a Honda Accord and let's start it running. Now remember, it's a hypothetical Honda Accord, it's not a real one. But we said if you start driving that car when Columbus set sail, you'd be running out of gas, about now.
That's a challenge I can really relate to, trying to break down a huge event or topic and make it understandable to the general public. It's something we deal with all the time reporting on the coast here. That's why you hear the expression of football field an hour about coastal land loss. What about finding good stories, though? It seems like that's really the thrust of the work that you do, and it's an important part of my job, too, when I'm doing it right. How do you go about finding them?
Well, I mean, my personal belief is that everyone's got a bunch of great stories. And really, we kind of find storytellers in a few different ways. Sometimes they find us. They've heard of our show and they want to contribute. Sometimes we get referrals. And then sometimes we go looking for people in unexpected places or perhaps expected places, but places where they might not know about Story Collider. And we're very excited about our upcoming show in New Orleans, where we're going to have a mix of scientists and fishermen sharing and talking about their experiences related to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill.
Give us a few more details on that event.
Great. So our Story Collider that will be in New Orleans is happening next Monday, February 6th. We're starting the show at 7 o'clock p.m., and it's located at Club 44 and Encore at Champion Square, and that's on LaSalle Street.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Ari Daniel, with Story Collider, for joining us on Inside the Arts today.
Thank you so much, Tegan, for having me.
Story Collider is free and open to the public. You can register at storycollider.org. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. A haunting tale of corruption in a broken city is the subject of acclaimed local playwright and UNO Associate Professor Justin Maxwell's new work, Niagara Falls, currently running at the Theater at St. Claude. Jim Fitzmaurice directs what is billed as a strange but familiar story. Justin and Jim are here. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Hi, nice to be here.
So tell us, what is haunting the stage at the Theater at St. Claude?
Literally, haunting the stage is a 300-year-old teenager who has been living at the bottom of a whirlpool.
Oh, my. So, Justin, what was the inspiration for Niagara Falls, and what exactly are you exploring in the work?
Well, the work actually started out with a very personal question. It's a piece that hits really close to home for me. I grew up just outside of Niagara Falls, and I watched a city die over the course of a couple decades. It was a thriving community that, through a variety of economic and social changes, fell apart. After I left the Rust Belt, I sort of looked back as a young adult starting to write and starting to make art and asked myself, how does a city die? And that became the impetus for the play.
And Jim, you were wearing a different hat. You're known for monologues and one acts, but you're directing, and do you have a role in the play?
I have a role in this play. I am playing the mayor of the city, and I am actually, when I say co-directing, I brought a young man in by the name of Logan Faust. I'm playing a corrupt mayor in charge of a city, so I'm a little bit familiar with that motif. So when I read this play, I felt like, despite the fact that it was set up on the American-Canadian border, and despite the fact that it dealt with a world that is so far removed geographically from New Orleans, mm-hmm. I just felt that there was something about a relationship between a corrupt mayor and a hooker with a heart of gold and a city full of ghosts and a city that resides someplace between disaster and beauty. That there might be something there that New Orleans audiences might find themselves gravitating towards. Let me just add, by the way, the play is very funny. You know, it sounds like this, you know, this gruesome tale, and it is, but it's also a very funny, gruesome tale.
So I hear tragedy, haunting, comedy. What's the storyline? How does this unfold?
Quite simply, the boy who's at the kind of the heart of the show is a real historical figure. He survived a massacre during the Seneca Wars in 1763. This is a real historical character who then disappears from the historical record. And the play starts with him sort of coming to at the bottom of this giant whirlpool that's just downriver from Niagara Falls, a place called Devil's Hole. And he comes up out of his stasis in this place underwater to explore the city and figure out what is going on after having centuries of debris fall on him. He's starting to encounter the real world of the suicide rate in Niagara Falls, where the people who are literally jumping off the cliff are getting washed into his whirlpool.
Is there something you can share from the production?
About half a century ago, my river started flowing backwards. New bodies started to swirl in. I couldn't keep up. Nothing really leaves the whirlpool. For centuries, everything spun counterclockwise. Then, one night, the water dropped 10 feet and changed direction. There was no current one way or the other. All my bodies collapsed to the bottom. I kept them all in place, orbiting for generations. Now the whirlpool changes direction and depth every 12 hours, all winter long. I don't want dead bodies to fall on me anymore.
Wow.
I really wanted to put a city up on stage. And of course, cities don't really fit on stage very well. So in some ways, I built a play out of foils to all sort of reflect some aspect of the condition of the place and to let their experiences then point towards the character of the city itself. A lot of the anecdotes in the piece are real. There's a mention of Love Canal. There's mention of some stores and some boarded up shops, which are all real places. I did a lot of research to make sure that at least at the time of the initial writing, all the facts that are given are up to date. So when, you know, someone talks about suicide rates or economic development or, you know, GDP or education levels, all of those things are pretty thoroughly researched, except for the mayor's bribe, which I just made up in case he wants to sue me. Some of the real experiences of him were outlandish enough. I didn't think anyone would believe them.
The problem is, though, I think you're right, except for in New Orleans. I think people would have been like, oh, no, that could happen. there is a toxic, leaking chemical dump in Niagara Falls that is six times the size of Love Canal. And
it's technically up towards Buffalo. I fudged a little bit on that.
Yeah, and I was horrified. Now, there's a very funny moment towards the end that I can't share because, you know. But it is so funny where the mayor gives his theory about what really wrecked Niagara Falls. He's wrong, but it has this kind of Freakonomics sort of feel to it about the honeymooners.
Yeah.
You know, what is it? All we have is a big cliff and a giant river, you know, which is, you know, really funny if you think about it.
Who else is in the cast?
Buddy Love, the Times-Picayune stepping out, and the New Orleans Advocate named her the best actress of the year last year. She's also an internationally renowned burlesque dancer. Margot Fanning, who was in The Book of Liz, and Matthew Michael, and a young man named Kyle Wood. So, yeah, it's a nice cast. David Raphael is our set designer, who's done marvelous work at Le Petit all over the city. And my fiance, Claire Marie, is our sound designer. And I mention her because that sound, as Justin
it's
can
so
tell you, it
so
is unbelievably complicated. Every scene has a button and a beginning, and there has to be ambient noise. It's a whirlpool. It's a whirlpool. There is an opening sound cue that is so physically disturbing that it's supposed to kind of create a rumble in your chest, and it gives way to an opening image that I hope will haunt people.
There are lots of questions being asked in this story, Niagara Falls. What answers might haunt audiences in this work that has such a familiar feel?
You know, Justin asked the question, how does a city die? And I hope New Orleanians come, and while they're laughing and also deeply disturbed in that almost horror movie way by some of the goings-on, also get the time to ask the question, how much of this can I relate to? And are there ways in my own community to not let this happen? Because there are discussions about money in this play, very brief ones, that New Orleanians will find, you know, the idea that I'm going to invest money in a company that manufactures plywood because when businesses close down here, I can make some money. I mean, it's almost like, you know, marble countertops. New Orleanians know what that means, too. You know, and the other thing is, why are there so many bodies in the water? Which, you know, is a very practical question in the play. But why are there so many bodies in the water is a question about history.
Playwright Justin Maxwell and director Jim Fitzmaurice. Thanks.
Thank you.
I believe the human being and the fish can coexist.
I believe the human being and the fish can coexist peacefully.
And the human being coexist.
Can coexist peacefully.
I believe the human being and the fish can coexist peacefully.
Can coexist peacefully.
I believe the human being and the fish can coexist peacefully.
Broken Habit Productions' presentation of Niagara Falls by Justin Maxwell continues its run at the Theater at St. Claude, 2240 St. Claude Avenue, with performances through Sunday, February 5th. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday performances are at 8 p.m. Sunday's showtime is 6 p.m. More info is online at thetheateratstclaude.com. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go inside the arts. I'm Diane Mack.